Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we're delighting in the creepy, the spooky, the skin-crawling aspects of food history and culture.
Give yourself over to man's more hedonistic tendencies, and you wouldn't be making it to the great beyond. The Sin Eater's job was to ensure that you did.
In modern horror, audiences have been captivated by the isolation, mystery, and terror of rural life.
And so one of these preparations is actually taking oak bark, stuffing it into a cow skull, and burying that cow skull in a creek for a year.
I would argue that their evil went hand in hand with their marketing strategy. I'm not saying they had an excuse, but in order to make bananas work, they were deluded. They had to do these terrible things.
Listen to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one of your hosts, Darren Bresnitz. This week, we are so excited to be sitting down with Chef Sean Brock at the ArcLight Cinemas Hollywood during the West Coast leg of his cookbook tour for his new book, South, Essential Recipes and New Explorations. It is an inspiring and informative chat about the ingredients, traditions, and techniques, and some of his favorite stories behind the Southern food he loves. There's also an incredible story about Bill Murray helping him plate a dish. Then we dig into the archives with Michael Davies, who is a Grammy-nominated roots musician. He talks about being an advocate for Brooklyn's bluegrass scene, and he gives us some tracks from his two album set, Orchards and Violets. So sit back, relax, and enjoy Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org.
We talk about food, we talk about music, with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
We'll be right back. Welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Darren Bresnitz. We are in the green room at the Arclight Theater in Hollywood, and we are with Sean Brock, legendary chef of the South, who wrote a book about the South and its food. Welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Thank you. So weird to be in Hollywood. That is a long way from Appalachia.
Yeah. I mean, but that's, if I haven't heard that story from the mountains of Appalachia to Hollywood 1,000 times.
I like Jesco White.
Yeah. So this is your second book, and your first book, Heritage, you know, received a ton of critical acclaim. It was a big success. So when you set out to write the second book after the first one's done so well, is there freedom? Is there pressure? How did you approach it?
Well, the first book was kind of a roadmap for the future, looking back and figuring out what used to be grown and eaten and cooked. And now this book is the product of that work of bringing all those things back. And it's asking the question, like, what can we do with these ingredients now? What's the future of these ingredients? Well, that makes writing a book very easy. Plus, this one it has a lot of recipes in it that are recipes that I've been working on for over, 15 years. So it's fun to share those with people.
I mean, this is a very personal journey for you, and there's a lot of people who, from family members to mentors and things like that, who help guide you have a better understanding of Southern food. And so how do you see this book as a guide for people who may have their own preconceived notions or think of Southern food in a specific way, other than what we maybe know, that it is healthier than people think it is, or that you do use fresh ingredients? What's a different perception you want people to walk away with after this book?
I hope it's the same perception that it's given me, and that's that I feel like now, more than ever, I know nothing about Southern food. I absolutely know nothing. Because now I'm starting to realize the scale of it. And I'm starting to realize how many traditions haven't even been born yet, because we're barely 250 years old as a country.
Right.
So this is a very young country, and we have so much more to discover.
You talk about the cuisine and that discovery, and one of the things is that it's a common thread between people. And you talk about these three factors of the people and the food and the culture experiences and the history that brings it together. And what do you notice it as a young cuisine compared to maybe like French and Italian cuisines as a common thread for our culture of where it's been and where it's going?
So if you go to the book on page 11, there's a map of continental Europe, Western Europe, and then there's a map of the South, kind of pulled away from the United States. It's kind of interesting to look at it as its own country for a moment beside that area of Western Europe. And the moment I started seeing it that way, it just helped me realize that it's not this monolithic cuisine. It's so many different cuisines throughout these little tiny micro regions. And those micro regions are unique because of the formula that makes up cuisine, the three P's: people, places, products. Mm-hmm. And that also shows that the future's going to be so different. I mean, Southern food in 10 years is going to be, it's going to be completely different. And I think the flavor of a place is dependent upon those things. And if you look at the demographics and racial compositions of each city in 10 years, that's the flavor of that place. And that's gonna evolve constantly.
You know, the products and the places can sometimes be fixed of just what the region allows to grow, but the people change and their roles in it. How do you see the people and how they've shaped history and your role in that and its influence on Southern cuisine?
Well, those people bring a couple of important things. They bring the ingredients along with them, because the ingredients that you're born into, like the ingredients that I was born into, the earliest foods that you eat, you form these narrow pathways that are your first flavor memories. And then those are the deepest ones because they're connected to your family and they're nostalgic. And so we then kind of crave those things no matter where we go. And so every culture has that. And it's the same with music. It's the same with art. Every culture has those things that they crave that are tucked away in their subconscious. And they're just, it's part of your DNA. And those flavors, and I'm specifically speaking about flavors, mm-hmm. Those flavors, when they are mashed up with the flavors that are there, with the ingredients that were there already, the native ingredients, but also the ingredients that you bring with you so that you can grow your food, those things, once they end up on the plate, that's the food of that place. And a great example of that would be where I'm from in Appalachia, in the coal fields of Virginia. And there, the major influences are Native American, or Cherokee, German, and Scots-Irish. Mostly German, then Scots-Irish. And so you see sour corn appearing on the table, a sauerkraut of corn. And when I grew up, I thought everybody ate that. You know, to me, it was our food. It was the food. And even as I got older, you know, to me, it was the food of my region. But it's a German tradition of fermenting and making sauerkraut with Native American ingredients. And then that only exists there. I don't think you're going to find sour corn in Germany.
No. I mean, the regionality also plays through your book in some of the different grids and the ways that you show, you talk about the hams and the shrimp and grits. How did you narrow it down even to the recipes that you have in there when you could have done probably a whole book on shrimp and grits and just ham itself? What was the important recipes that you felt that you had to share that really stood in for maybe the recipes that couldn't quite make it in?
That's something that I had to ask for a lot of help with because there was so... This book could have been three times the size.
Easily. Oh, easily.
Yeah. And going through and starting to cut things is really tough. And so that involves a large team because it takes many perspectives and many ideas and many opinions on what's important. So it's just like writing a song. It's just like creating a dish. You have to edit it down to its simplest form so that it can be more easily understood.
A lot of respect is paid throughout this book to both the traditions and both the ingredients that are grown. And you deal a lot with focusing on seasonal and local food, but it's not just about a talking point. It really is about people looking inward and reconsidering how they get their food, where their food comes from. Sometimes that can be considered a luxury, that people can't go to the farmer's market or even a matter of affording it. What would you advise to people who want to practice some of what you preach in the book, but maybe can't go to some of the extremes of going to their farmer or you know, buying boutique lettuce or turnips and things like that?
God, I hope they don't do any of those things, honestly. I hope they grow it themselves like we did, or find neighbors that grow things. I mean, in my neighborhood in East Nashville, there's a guy who grows food in his backyard, and then he just writes on a huge cardboard sign whatever it is he wants to sell that day, and that's what you stop and get. And that's how, if we start with the smaller units of community, that's just how I grew up, and I think that's where it can start. And you know, the idea of growing your own food obviously can only exist when you have dirt to put it in. But my advice is, if you can't do that, my advice is to spend your money wisely. Consider each dollar a vote, because every dollar you spend is supporting that farmer in a way that will allow him to then grow on a larger scale, which allows for the price to drop. And also, I think just buy the best that you can afford.
It really is about building this community and creating this new ecosystem, both as, you know, you buy the green beans from someone who grows it, then you pickle them, you give it to someone else, they maybe use them in their restaurant. Why or how has Southern food really come to represent the building of community and community ties?
Well, most of the traditions that I enjoy the most are the ones that I recall as a kid being these enormous communal activities, such as sorghum potlucks or the time of year where you make the apple butter. In lots of places, there's a hog slaughtering time of year, and the existence of a community cannery. And these things allow us to stay in touch. They allow us to use food as the common thread, which is what I think its greatest ability is.
There's also this dedication to time, both to enjoy yourself in cooking and the way things that people make stuff. And I loved that part where John Egerton talks to you about the biscuits and about roll the cold dough 500 times for family and 1,000 for the president. Which I thought was a really funny quote, but also spoke to the time it takes to really do something right and to really put the effort into it, but also to slow down and to think about what you're cooking, what you're buying, how you're serving it to people, and how that transfers into this tradition. We move so quickly these days. How would you recommend people carving out the time to make this food or to approach this type of cuisine?
Well, I want to talk about the importance of that, and the importance of how food can be the tool that allows us to ponder and consider and to think about the cultures that provided it and the history of wherever your place is. You know, when I eat Papa John, I'm thinking about how screwed up slavery was. And that makes me feel really terrible, and that's good. That's a good thing that I'm feeling that guilt, because that's what we should be thinking about, and we should be talking about these things. And food allows that. And so, if you're no matter where you're eating, if you're at Taco Bell, you know, have just this moment to think about what that culture is like.
Amazing. Well, we're going to take a quick musical break, song from the archives, and then we're going to come back here on Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org.
We're precarious.
Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2-Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Hello and welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We are with Sean Brock talking about his new book. And the book talks so much about traditional techniques and history and about finding the right one that's for you. I'm thinking about how many different ways you talk about cooking over fire in this book and how you sort of say there is no wrong way or right way. Here's how I would do it, but you got to be comfortable with your own mode of fire cooking and what makes the most sense for if you have a giant backyard or you have a small Weber. It doesn't matter as long as you make the effort. How do you want to inspire people to get out of their comfort zones when it comes to these types of cookings and this approach to making food?
The only way you're going to get better is to make mistakes. And mistakes are such a gift because that's where a lot of my greatest discoveries have come from. And also, I think one of the great lessons that I've learned over the past few years is the power of courage and just to be able to encourage someone or to find courage within yourself. We're so capable of so much more than we lead ourselves to believe. And if you can start thinking that way towards food, hopefully you can look at the rest of life that way.
I know you talk about the bologna in the book as something that is going to take a bunch of times to make, and you're going to make some mistakes at the beginning. Were there any other recipes that are in the book where if you read it, you go, I can never do this, and you felt the same way at the beginning, and now you read it, and you go, like, I too was in your shoes at one point?
So, in all honesty, I can't imagine myself making bologna at home after, you know, I mean, it's one of those things, but I've made it so many times, hundreds and hundreds of times.
Is it just the idea of mounting Mount Bologna, of just like starting at the bottom, being like, I don't know if I can climb you again?
You know, but the important thing to remember, just like how to make your own butter and how to make your own vinegars, is the learning that happens as you're going along. And making your own butter sounds difficult.
But I mean, making the butter part is one of the longest recipes in the book. And and the first thing they start with is sourcing milk from the right cow.
Yeah, exactly.
So you got to have a milk guy first.
Yeah, you got to have a milk dude.
But I mean, you started off with all these just being an idea and just being like, can we do this? How do we take it? And we do it one way and then we refine it.
And that's, I think, what's fun about this book is this is a collection of all those things that I've spent hours and hours and years and years and years trying to obsessively master. Even if it's as simple as a fried green tomato, I've been trying to master that since I was a teenager. And now that recipe's in this book. And that will save you so much time and so much misery.
I did it here. Like, you can try it your own way, but trust me on this one. One of my favorite recipes you have is the sack sausage, which you could also put in a sock as
right.
Well.
Depends on how much money you got, I guess.
Yeah, but I love that because going back to the butter, you talk about buying a specific butter muslin that you're only, you know, cheesecloth that you're only going to ever use for that type of thing. But it goes, yeah, or you could just go go to the 99 cent store and get a sock, but it's really just about getting out there and trying.
Yeah, it's about doing it. And thinking about the people who did it before you and like what how important it is to carry on traditions of doing things by hand. Like making things with your hands, that's what it's all about.
Speaking of tradition, the history and the credit, I know we talked in it a little bit, but it does play a lot of a lot in this book. Like anytime someone taught you something or you learned under someone, you give them a shout out. You know, like the grilled asparagus that Brian Baxter taught you, or something that your grandmother taught you. Like you never just say, "I'm now the master of this." Why is it important to not to say you didn't invent it, but to give credit where credit's due? With this type of book and this type of cuisine?
I think it shows humility and vulnerability, and you know, it's that I hope encourages other people to seek these kinds of techniques and recipes from other people, and realize that the one of the best things you can do is listen, and one of the best things you can do is try and understand what other people are getting excited about, what other people are good at, and that's how I've spent my entire career.
The book is big. There are so many recipes, and in reading it, when I thought I got to one section, I was like, oh, how many recipes can we fit into this? There's ones where there's not even photos, just recipe, 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 recipe. But everyone gets the same respect. Like, I feel that every recipe could be your favorite, but you do talk about the shrimp and oyster purlieu, which I'd never heard of before, and you say it's 100% your kind of dish. So if you love this cuisine, you love all these dishes, how does something like this rise to the top of being a favorite dish? What does it mean to you? Mm-hmm. And why does a dish out of a cuisine that you have built your life around become your favorite?
There is, I noticed this when I listened to certain songs. Sometimes it just hits you square in the chest and like your eyes start watering. It just, so that is like one of the most incredible things. And when a dish does that to me, I pay attention, and that makes me want to share it with other people.
You talk about these recipes as stuff that you've served in your restaurant, and some of them are for home. How do you draw the distinction of this, what some people could say rustic, but some people could say refined? Like, where do you say this is something that's restaurant worthy and this is something that you serve in the backyard on a Saturday night?
Well, I've always had one modern restaurant and one simpler, more casual restaurant. And I honestly believe there's room for both. And, you know, diversity is what it's all about, and there's 7 days in a week, so you got plenty of time to play. I think understanding what you are capable of doing is really, really important. Understanding, because if you try to take on too much, and if you try to do too much and you fail, then you're going to get really upset and not have a good time and probably not try any more recipes.
Do you people get frustrated with these recipes sometimes and ever reach out to you for encouragement?
Oh, all the time. The hot sauce recipe in the first book, I get 3 or 4 messages a week when people see the mold forming, but that's the secret to the flavor.
Is it the mold?
Mm-hmm.
There are so many great stories in this book, and I love the one with you and David Chang and Alan Benton. Being out in nature and then cooking and things like that. That's the type of story where you go, I'm giving up my job. I'm getting into cooking. You know, I'm just going to go out and forage and try and get a couple buddies just to have these types of moments. What other stories came out from this book and putting it together? What are the stories that stand out for you in this journey to writing this book?
Gosh, that was a really good one.
That was a really good one.
That was a really, really, really good one. There's so many that I didn't get to write about. There's so many that I look forward to writing about in the future. Like, for instance, the swordfish with green gumbo.
Mm-hmm.
I was having trouble plating that dish, and just so happened Bill Murray was at the restaurant while I was shooting the dish, and he came over and was like, "What are you doing?" I'm like, "I'm having trouble plating this dish. Just can't make it look right." He was like, "Well, what are you trying to do?" I'm like, "I don't know. I just want it to look cool." And he goes, "Let me see that thing." And he starts plating it, and he sits back. He plated the dish, and he laughs, and he goes, "See, it's done. Made me laugh." And I'll never forget that, because he's like, "I know something special when I get like a little chuckle out of it. It's like, when I look at art, it makes me laugh." It's like, that's my favorite.
That's amazing. You know, you're carrying on a lot of tradition in this book and in the restaurants and the food you serve. Do you feel a certain weight on your shoulders? Do you feel a responsibility to be this collective information? And I know that you've physically done it with the preservation of seeds and growing plants and things like that, but now you're passing on knowledge. And how much responsibility weighs on you to get that right, or to get as much information out as you possible? Because you mentioned that you had to edit some stuff out. Do you lose sleep over the stories that you couldn't tell, or be like, "I need enough time to write another book and a third book and so on"?
You know, being in recovery and having a child has helped me realize what's worth worrying about. And at this moment in my life, I don't want any pressure on my shoulders. I just, you know, I'm glad I got to have a big chunk of my life where I was able to dedicate all of my energy towards these things. But now my favorite thing is to encourage the next generation and to watch these things happen naturally. It's just been absolutely incredible.
With all the research and everything and going through all this, what do you, at the end of the day, consider to be the most important or your favorite staple of Southern cooking, and why? What tells the story the best?
Well, that's a tough one because it depends on where you are. But I do think that cornbread is the one that you'll see on the most tables throughout the microregions of the South. And that cornbread, wherever you're at, think about the color, the texture, the flavor. Does it have sugar? Does it have flour? Does it have a crispy crust? Is it more cake-like? And those questions and that kind of curiosity will lead you down a path where you start to wonder about the cultural influences of that place and why that cornbread is that way. There's 5 different recipes in the book, and that's something that hit me when I started opening husks in various cities. And those different skillets of cornbread in each place had to appeal to the nostalgia of the people who were from there.
Wow. So not one cornbread for all the husks, but a cornbread specific to the region.
Yeah.
I know at the beginning you talked about how we've barely scratched the surface. There's so much more to learn. But in writing this book, what is the one thing that you learned that surprised you the most or shifted your perception about what you thought about Southern food?
Well, I would say that for me, the thing that I learned the most is I love thinking that I know something and then realizing that I know nothing. Because I've spent a big chunk of my life studying Southern food. And when I finished this book, I realized that there are so many more books that need to be written. And that's really exciting for me. Just to know that for the rest of my life, I can concentrate on this one region and just explore with curiosity and see what the possibilities are and what the discoveries can be of each place. I think the biggest takeaway for this book was how excited I am for the future and seeing what Southern food's going to be like in a decade from now. And that makes me really happy.
Amazing. Well, congratulations, Chef.
Thank you.
The book is South. Where can people get it? Where can people follow your adventures?
ChefSeanBrock.com.
Beautiful. Well, we have another song from the archives and then a live performance here on Snacky Tunes on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Heritage Radio Network on Monday, November 11th, for a raucous feast to toast a decade of food radio. Our 10th anniversary Bacchanal is a rare gathering of your favorite chefs, mixologists, storytellers, thought leaders, and culinary masterminds. We'll salute the inductees of the newly minted HRN Hall of Fame, who embody our mission to further equity, sustainability, and deliciousness. Join us to explore the beautiful Palm House and Yellow Magnolia Cafe at the Brooklyn Botanic Garden, where you'll taste and imbibe to your heart's content, and bid on once-in-a-lifetime experiences and tasty gifts for any budget at our silent auction. Join the party. Tickets are available now at heritageradionetwork.org/gala.
All right. Michael and crew, welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Hey there.
You want to go around the room and introduce yourselves?
Sure, absolutely. Here, we got on the mandolin, we got Dominic Leslie and Jen Larson. She's going to be singing here with me. And on the bass, Larry Cook.
Welcome from across the room. I mean, across the trailer.
Glad to be here.
I'm so excited you're here because the record you just put out is such an amazing concept that, like, I think people kind of, like, dream about that an artist would do, but you actually did it. For those of you who don't know, it's called Orchids and Violence on Nonesuch, which is equally just, like, one of the best labels that's ever existed in the history of labels.
I agree, yeah.
Just if you are into, like, music that is just good across all type of genres, just, like, just go listen to everything they've ever done.
They've got a pretty amazing output over the last 50 years or so.
It's pretty incredible. But what you've done, and just to for the people who are not prepared for this episode, you took pretty much the same song and did it twice.
Yeah, it's the same 12 songs. It started with 12 mostly traditional songs, or you know, like old time and bluegrass and you know old murder ballads and whatnot. And I did the same track list on two discs. So the first disc is like straight ahead bluegrass, which is pretty much what we're going to be playing today. And the second disc, I did the same songs in the same order, but it's kind of an experimental electric album. So reinterpreted them kind of from the ground up in some cases.
And I'm sure that you'll probably get this question asked to you through all the interviews, but like, where did this come from and why did you feel the desire to do this?
Well, I came out of bluegrass music. That's something I grew up with. So my parents played fiddle and banjo, so it was in the household growing up. And it's always just been a part of who I am, as you know, personally and musically, and something I've really gravitated back to, especially in the last 10 years of my life or so. I just really ended up doing primarily bluegrass music. But, along the way, definitely gotten way into other forms of music, you know, experimental music, jazz, noise rock, mm-hmm. All these, different influences are also part of me. And so when I wanted to record an album and was trying to figure out what sort of album I wanted to do, and I knew I wanted to do something that really kind of hung together as a piece. You know, I didn't want to just kind of record a collection of tunes and kind of have it be a bunch of singles. And I didn't want to do sort of a mishmash of too many influences. I wanted it to be kind of about one thing. But then I couldn't really figure out whether to kind of do the traditional bluegrass thing, which has really been a big part of what I've done in the last 10 years, or express some of these kind of more experimental ideas. And so this was a solution. This double album concept was kind of...
Someone called a solution. Someone called, like, masochistic.
Yeah, yeah, it was an opportunity to take these old songs, which, you know, many of which have been around for hundreds of years, who knows how long. Some of these old murder ballads are, you know, really hundreds of years old, and have had a lot of life, you know, even before bluegrass music was a thing. And, so they just, you know, they get performed in the style of whoever's performing them, you know, whether it's, you know, 1750 or 1900 or 1950 or now, and you know, everyone just kind of brings their own experience to it. So it was just kind of taking part of the process of, you know, people have for years, you know, hundreds of years, continually reworked these songs. So just getting to explore them in, you know, very much in the bluegrass tradition, which you know, again, I love and primarily work in, with a band of musicians that I just really wanted to get together in a room, but then also take those same songs.
Do you find that every time you explore a song or re-explore it, it extends its life and gives it a new lease on it?
Well, I believe that's what these songs are meant for. You know, these songs have been around for hundreds of years. You know, they're enduring because they have a way of they are sort of a template or a container for the experience and the emotions of whoever's singing them. And so, you know, everyone who sings these songs, it's a folk tradition, and so everyone sort of brings their own perspective to it. And, you know, these are two musical perspectives that I was able to present on this recording, you know, the bluegrass and the sort of more experimental side, which also gave me an opportunity to kind of explore the contrasts and versions and kind of the puzzle for me to solve.
Which I think we definitely want to address, but because you said it twice, murder ballads. What makes a good murder ballad for the uninitiated?
Oh, man. Well, there's so many murder ballads to choose from. And
is that like a canon? I mean, is that a canon?
Yeah,
music?
It's a genre. Yeah, absolutely. There's a bunch of great ones. You know, I recorded Pretty Polly on these albums. You know, The Knoxville Girl, Omi Wise, you know, Banks of the Ohio. It goes on and on. There are so many of them that are done to this day. And they're all so brutal.
I think what makes a really good torch song, like, you know, you hear a good torch and you're like, damn, that's really good. They really love that person. Like, what makes like a good murder ballad?
Well, it's you know, it's got to be gruesome and brutal. I mean, I think people
right.
sort of need that artistic engagement with you know, with death, with violence, with brutality. You know, we have that in you know, in horror movies and action movies, you know, and I think it's important for people to kind of get to engage in that in a song, you know, rather than in real life experience.
Okay, I just got threatened on the radio. You all heard this.
Well, you know, that's why we have these songs. You know, yeah. they're songs that just express, you know, all aspects of human experience You know, and so in these singing these songs and hearing these songs, you feel this kind of pathos for the victim, and you want the perpetrator to be brought to justice. And you know, one of my favorite ones, "Knoxville Girl," which was most famously recorded by the Lubin Brothers. I mean, part of is that they record that song in such a kind of upbeat manner. They're like, I met a little girl in Knoxville. And it's very, it's almost kind of like upbeat and happy sounding, like they're at a party or something, but it's this gruesome murder, and that sort of makes it all the more twisted,
right?
That it's, you know, I've also, there's a great recording of Nick Cave singing Knoxville Girl, which is totally the other way.
Oh,
he's
man.
Like, he seems way into it.
Yeah
but that's what you
he's
want
like
that.
He's like, wish I was there.
Yeah.
Can we hear what are you gonna play for us first?
Sure. Well, this is not a murder ballad.
No,
at
okay,
all.
No.
Actually, this is after all this talk about old songs, we're actually gonna lead off with the song that I recorded. This is the one song on the record that's not an old traditional number. It's actually by a Seattle band called Mother Love Bone, a proto grunge band who I really love.
Yeah, they're wonderful.
Yeah, they're awesome. Yeah, and they broke up, some of their members went on to form Pearl Jam and other bands. Anyways, but I thought this would make a good bluegrass song.
Okay.
It's called Stargazer.
Wonderful.
Okay.
Let's do it.
No murders.
No murders.
Gives me higher than anyone.
When you were writing this, like, what came first, the bluegrass song or the rock version?
Well, I mean, this. I'm sorry. When I was arranging it,
yeah. Well, I mean, more than that, like when you were putting the two kind of like records together, did you do all the bluegrass versions first, or did you do a bluegrass one and then you did the rock version of that? Like, how did that come?
Yeah.
To be?
Well, the electric versions kind of started out maybe about 8 years ago. I had. Kind of come up with a batch of arrangements. I was at the time playing drums, and guitar and singing at the same time. Mm. So sitting down, and my wife was playing bass. So we kind of arranged, maybe about six or seven old bluegrass songs for that format. And that was sort of the seed of the electric record. And I knew I want, you know, what direction I wanted to take that in for the recording to some degree. And then I picked the songs we're going to go on each album, and since we recorded the bluegrass record first, so those got finished and arranged first, and then, of course, once that was set and I knew what that was going to sound like, then this idea continued to evolve as far as how to arrange the electric stuff, because it was sort of a puzzle and a project of kind of getting each album to flow differently and really have its own identity that would stand alone. You know, without needing the other album, but you know, making sure each song, was different, and you know, if you did listen to them side by side, there would be some interesting contrast there.
Awesome. Can you talk a little bit about the difference in the recording process for the two albums? and your approach to each one.
Sure. Yeah. The recording process was really different for the bluegrass record. We did it all live in a big room over 3 days. Recorded a tape in the Old First Church in Brooklyn. They have an upper hall there, which is amazing sounding for acoustic music. And so we just did it with four microphones, four tracks, and just got everyone there playing together, bleeding into the other mics, and just kind of recording the sound of the room. So the concept was it was kind of a recorded event. Mm. We didn't really do any overdubs or edits, or we did just a few edits, but it was basically a live event. And then
for those who can't see in the room here, they're all just standing around one mic. This, like, I feel like we just went back to how radio used to happen with you guys. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, a lot of bluegrass bands will perform, like the whole band will perform around a single condenser mic.
Yeah, it's I feel blessed.
we prefer it.
Yeah.
Anyways, but the electric record was done over about 3 months in my, I did most of it in my home studio and, some of it in other rooms. And, I played most of the instruments, myself. I had, my wife, Jessie Carter, played bass on it. And, we had a cameo in one song by, Tony Trischka on the banjo, but everything else I just tracked myself. So it was not at all done live. It was, a layered studio creation. And that was kind of part of the concept there, and kind of creating the contrast is to have the recording processes being very different.
3 days versus 3 months,
That's, yeah.
a bit of a difference. And for people who are listening to them side by side, you don't need to give away all the secrets, but is there anything or any particular pairing of tracks that you would point out that you were happy or surprised by how they sounded side by side?
Well, maybe it's a good time to bring up the vinyl release. It just came out last week. The double CD, which came out at the end of February, is called Orchids and Violence, and then we just released a vinyl edition called Violence and Orchids. And the difference is that it's just the vinyl edition is just one disc, and it takes five songs, five each from the bluegrass and the electric discs, and then kind of interleaves them. So you get the bluegrass version of June Apple, the electric version of June Apple, and it's a whole sequence that's kind of designed to sort of highlight the contrast between the tracks. So I would encourage you to check that out and decide for yourself.
and which one is which? Which is the bluegrass and which is the electric? Is it orchids? Which one's orchids? Which one's violence?
I won't commit. The whole thing is just called Orchids and Violence.
Okay.
You can think of that what you will.
Maybe while we're doing a murder ballad, I'll get you to tell me. do you want to play another one for us?
Sure. I'm going to do a song while Larry on bass. We're going to give you a little break. You can go have some whiskey and pizza. But Jen Larson and I are going to sing this as a duet and with Dominic on the mandolin. Recorded this one on the record. Did as a duet with Sarah Jarosz. Mm-hmm. And it's written by Whit Khanna, who's he and his wife Barbara down in Atlanta are my musical godparents. I'm sending this out to Whit and Barbara. Whit song called Dark Angel. It's not a murder ballad, but there is death.
We're getting there.
Involved.
We're getting there. We're getting close.
We got three songs today, so it's called Dark Angel. Forgive me.
I'm here though. Just her and her children, where I don't know. Said her husband died a drunkard, it was a shame. And he spoke my name. I saw angels fly, and darkly they came.
So, record's out, vinyl's out.
Yes.
You had some release shows.
Yes.
What comes this summer?
Well, actually, there's one more release show. We're having a vinyl release show this Thursday in Brooklyn at Littlefield, which is in Gowanus on DeGrasse Street. And so that's going to feature both the electric band and the bluegrass band.
I was going to ask, like, how does the live – obviously, we get the bluegrass, but how do the live shows work? How does like the set list work too?
For the CD release shows we did in New York back in March, it was the same as what we're doing this Thursday, which is have the bluegrass band play in the first set and the electric band play in the second set. Mm. For this, since this is the vinyl release show, each band is going to start out playing the five songs that are on the vinyl release.
Oh wow!
So at the beginning of each set, you'll get to hear the contrasting versions of those songs.
That's incredible. You're obviously doing double duty, but is anybody else wearing two hats or just two basses?
Well, on this Thursday playing banjo with me is Tony Trischka, who's legendary banjo player. So really lucky to have him. And Tony is the only musician other than myself who played on both discs. Mm. He played on one song on each disc, and so we're gonna do that song, Darlin' Corey, which actually we're going to close with today, but you'll hear Tony playing on the bluegrass and on the electric versions. But other than that, the band is different.
And then are you able to take both out on the road, or do you have to pick
one side?
No, it's not really road material there to travel with two bands. I'm playing with the bluegrass band. We're doing Rocky Grass Festival out in Colorado.
Oh,
which is
great.
A great bluegrass festival. And I'm doing a trio tour in June, June 9th, 10th, and 11th, with Noam Bikilny on banjo and Brittany Haas on fiddle, who both played on the record. So that'll be the bluegrass sides. We're playing World Cafe in Philadelphia, Cafe 939 in Boston, and the Parlor Room in Northampton, Mass. That's going on the road. And the electric band, which is now called Wax Lion, we're doing mostly New York shows. And that's with Jesse Carter on bass and Kid Millions on drums, who plays Oneida, and with Laurie Anderson and many other musicians. He's incredible, and so it's been a total joy working with him. If I had known him, I would have gotten him to play on the record. I actually played drums myself on the record, and then started working with Kid Millions on for the release shows, and that it's hopefully gonna kind of be an ongoing project under the name Wax Lion.
Before we have one more song, kind of final question is, from really diving in and approaching these songs in like two very different ways, did it give you like any deeper appreciation either for the way the songs are constructed or the subject of the songs themselves?
Well, these songs are very malleable, and if to me it's a way of honoring the songs, to show that they work in different ways. Some bluegrass purists might be offended that I'm adding fuzz pedals and a bunch of weird stuff on the second record, but I would argue that it's actually out of deep respect of the songs and of the tradition of these songs, to do them two ways. And so some of them are about something specific like a murder or whatever, but a lot of these old songs are not really necessarily about anything in particular, or they don't need to be. And so I think they're made, what I think it shows me is that they're made to just kind of, for each performer to kind of put their own, experience into it. And I think that that's why they're around for hundreds of years, and some of them will probably still be around 100 years from now. People will be doing all sorts of different weird things with them, I hope.
Yeah. Well, thanks for coming.
Thank you for all of us.
Where can people find you, get the record, sign up for tour dates, all the good stuff?
Yeah, well, you can get all that information at my website, michaeldaves.com, D-A-V-E-S. You can get the vinyl and the CD through Nonesuch Records website and, you know, Amazon, iTunes, all that stuff. Can't get the vinyl from iTunes. That's, I think, what we like about vinyl.
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah, but
the one trick. Well, we want to thank you for coming by. Thank you to Tracy and Josh from Kings County Imperial. Please come to the barbecue on Tuesday. Shout out to Mom, Dad, Ornella, and the whole new Meatball Ace family and Bresnitz.
Shout out to Meatball. Shout out to Hannah. Shout out to the West Coast.
Okay.
Hello, West Coast. Yeah, give up again for Dominic Leslie on the mandolin. Yeah. Jen Larson singing with me and Larry Cook on bass. Great to get to work with these guys.
Yeah, thank you for coming by. What are you going to take us out with?
Darling Corey.
Okay.
Yeah.
Have a good rest of the week.
Yeah, you too. Thank you.
Is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.